Welcome to the House of Strauss on the Athletic Podcast Network.
House of Strauss is brought to you by Game Time, your new go-to app for the best deals on last-minute tickets. Ticket prices drop right before the game starts, and because Game Time tracks prices in real time from thousands of trusted sellers, they're able to show you the best last-minute deals with prices up to 60% off.
60% off?
Yeah, 60% is a pretty good deal, Jade. And not only is it a good deal, it's not just sports tickets that you can get.
Yeah.
When I'm looking at the Chase Center upcoming schedule, Jade, you've also got music tickets as well. Jade, I know you're a huge music fan.
I love my music.
Yeah. I don't know if necessarily you'll be going to the Cher concert on November 21st, November 22nd, but upcoming on November 28th at Chase, you've got the Chainsmokers.
I like it.
Andrea Bocelli, I know you're a fan.
Oh, one of my favorites. Time to Say Goodbye. Check that out. And then a little Ariana Grande.
Ah, she's talented. One of the best musical mimics in the business, in addition to being a pop superstar. So, with that in mind, the Game Time app is simple, quick, and easy to navigate. Download the Game Time app in the Google Play or App Store and score last-minute deals on tickets up to 60% off. 60%. Incredible deal.
Well, that is the best pod I've ever been on.
Hello.
Hello.
It's me. It's me you're looking for.
I wish I could see.
I can see it in your eye.
Jane, take it away.
Me?
Yes. Oh,
don't take it away. Don't take.
Yesterday, I got wrapped into a rabbit hole of. I don't know anything about new music these days, but somehow I got wrapped into a rabbit hole of Billie Eilish on Howard Stern. And it was just, it was a really good interview. And her brother, whose name I can't remember, but he seems good as well. It was a really good interview, and it was interspersed with live performances in front of Howard Stern that then Howard Stern would go, oh, that's just great. Oh, that's great. I like that. It's just, I found it very engaging.
Is Howard Stern still doing shows? This is me being so out of touch with him.
No, I felt the same way. I don't track Howard Stern. I don't know how I came across this. He still does his radio show. And I just came away incredibly impressed with her. I think she's 17 years old. And I know I'm pretty late to this because she's I think she's been a celebrity since she was 14. But she can sing. I mean, I didn't know. I just see somebody I know. They're a pop star. That's about all I know about them. But seeing Billie Eilish sing acoustically in front of Howard Stern, I was completely blown away.
Don't you know I'm no good for you? I've learned to lose. You can't afford to. Tore my shirt to stop you bleeding. But nothing ever stops you leaving. Quiet.
That's how
talent.
I feel about Ariana Grande.
Hey,
I was like, wait, I know, that's what I'm saying. Is like, I was like, oh, these little teeny boppers, these millennials, they don't know what real pipes are. Go listen to Whitney Houston. And then Ariana Grande did like a Whitney Houston impression. I was like, wait, is she better at Whitney Houston than Whitney Houston?
I think that really helped her gain credibility outside of pop was going on SNL and imitating the other singers. In theory, it wouldn't take that. For some reason, that was the best showcase. That was the best showcase of her talent.
Like they do this Jimmy Fallon gimmick. I think Jimmy Fox does it and Celine Dion does it. Basically, they do impressions of other musicians and they do it to a backdrop of like weird instrument or weird genres. It's like sing Hey Ya, but in polka. And Jimmy Fallon, of course, you know, does it and it's great. It's great TV because then you get
So are you suspicious? Because I know how Jade would watch that. He would watch it going, come on, this is not improvised. They
planned it's 100% staged. Because they do the – and this is me talking, who still believes that the volume meter, the decibel meter in arenas is legit. That, you know, they do that little like cycling through, and it's like they're spinning the Wheel of Fortune, and oh my goodness, it's this particular song and artist that – it sounds like, you know, Jimmy Fallon has practiced over and over, but no, of course, he's just doing it live for the first time.
The child was taking a bath. Bubbles surrounded the young boy's head. Floating in the water was a toy. Rubber ducky, you're the one.
You make bad there?
Sorry, wrapping up an argument with my wife.
By the way, Tom, I'm in my car doing this because...
Is your mic on, Ethan?
Let me see.
That's your mic. It sounds like your mic. It just has a strange car sound effect.
Does your Prius have a mic?
Tap on the mic.
Is a Prius so...
There it is.
Maybe I need
so
to turn
cutting
it up.
Edge that it has a...
No. Don't turn it up.
Okay. I think it's good enough sound
in here.
Turn
it down now. Oh, there you go.
Okay. We're Goldilocks in this shit. I think the sound might be suboptimal. The main problem is that I'm freezing. That's the main issue right now. It is very cold in the morning in the Bay Area. What's the weather out there in Charlotte?
I would say someone's running past my house right now in a hat, a knit hat, and a sweater, and like running pants. It's like 45 and rainy, so it's beautiful out right now.
Wow, we have the same exact weather right now.
Same, yeah, 48 and rainy.
Wow,
in Oakland,
America, this is you.
Wow, connected, incredible. Oh, Allie says hi, by the way.
Hi, Allie. My Allie says hi, and my dog says hi, and my kid says hi. We have, if people don't know, we have mirrored lives. Like, have you watched that show, the Paul Rudd show, where there's two versions of yourself?
I saw the memes.
No, not that.
No, I
that's from
seen
Hot
those.
Ones, and it's a brilliant show. I love Hot Ones, but the actual show, the Netflix show that Paul Rudd does, where he goes to the doctor to basically take a PED on his life. Like, I'm going to go to this weird store, like almost like the Tom Brady thing. There's like a big Tom Brady controversy of him going to a strip mall massage and being a shot at Robert Kraft doing that.
Living with yourself.
Mm. And it's brilliant. It's a great show because what happens is, not to do any spoilers, but this is the pitch. He goes, and instead of getting an upgrade, he ends up getting an upgrade, but also the normal version of himself. And he has to live and switch in and out of his upgraded, perfect version of himself. And he hates that guy. He hates the perfect version of himself. He's a better lover. He's a better humanitarian. He's smarter. People love him at parties. And he has to watch how this other version of himself is so much better. And he realizes that he's got to figure out how to kick him out of his life, and he can't.
He resents his realized potential. That's very interesting. And to explain, because I think, Jade, are we recording? Are we going already? Are we doing this?
You guess. What do you think?
I know we're always recording. What am I talking about? There's no off the record here. Tom is making reference. Tom Haverstraw, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't know, and you probably know. We have mirrored lives in the sense of our wives have the same name and are both teachers, to which Amin al-Hassan once said, this is either a grand coincidence or Ethan is a very uncreative liar, which got a good laugh out of me. But yeah, that somehow that's happened. I don't know how.
We have black dogs.
Oh, and we have black dogs who are mutts, and that as well. How's Coop doing? How old is he right now? I mean, Coop's been on the scene for a while.
The way you asked me that, you're like, I'm expecting him to say he's dead.
No, I know he's alive. I just want to know how old he is.
He's 11 and a half.
See, there you go.
And we're getting construction in the backyard, and you'll appreciate this because you have a dog. He was constipated and just tried to go. I was taking him on a walk, and he just tried to go, and nothing was happening. You know, he turned the faucet on, and nothing was coming out. And so we took him to the doctor, and turns out he was eating mulch and sand in the backyard because the construction workers were leaving like their leftover lunches just in the trash. And he had gotten into it and started eating their leftover food, but also eating the side items of sand and mulch. So he was all stopped up.
Okay.
But mulch, other than that, he's
mulch
doing great.
Is bad. Oh, bad, Tom.
Mulch, yeah, it's heavy mulch, stuff, yeah. Man.
I'm always interested in how dogs don't seem to have an ick factor. I would like to know if anything can gross out a dog. And it almost seems to be inversely correlated, where the more disgusting something is, the more they want to have it. And I don't know if they're wrong or if their sense of smell is so refined that they can just find notes in the scent of it that are above what we can appreciate, that we are almost like little babies to them, where in the way that kids can't appreciate mustard or can't appreciate olives or anything bitter, they don't have the refined palate. I think that's how dogs think about us, in their inability to eat all these things and enjoy them.
Do you know the food that Americans love that around the world is revolting?
Cheese.
Well, yeah, but like, I don't think Americans are known for their cheese, so to speak. But peanut butter.
Huh.
What?
Yeah. It's like, why do people love peanut butters? I love Reese's peanut butter cups are number one on my Halloween power rankings. Mm. I love peanut butter. And it's one of the – I think it was Andrew Zimmern, Bizarre Foods. He came up with this, and he realized that like people just don't understand how – I think it's cheese is up there and peanut butter.
So I'm picturing an Andrew Zimmern type show from another country where the host is shaking his head and everybody around him is kind of quivering as he eats the slice of bread with peanut butter slathered on it, that this is the big dare.
And he's like, here's my Wagyu beef here that I'm eating. Oh my God, it's disgusting. Yes.
Well, it is interesting. It's what you grew up with. I remember reading a book called, I think it was called Shark's Fin Soup in Sichuan Pepper, a memoir about a woman. She came over from England in the early 90s to China, I think in the Chengdu province, and learned to be a chef. And it was pre a lot of China getting globalized in a way. And so she saw a lot of interesting things. And the people – and I think it's different in China now. People are more used to Western kinds of food and have more familiarity with milk and cheese. But they were just disgusted by cheese. And one of the people in the book described it as mucus from a cow's guts left to rot. And when I read that, I thought to myself,
yeah,
fair. Fair.
Yeah.
I love cheese, but that's fair. I mean, if you had never eaten cheese before, how gross is cheese?
I mean, I did a story for Bleacher Report about Kyrie Irving going vegan, which seems like 10 years ago now that the whole – this was at a time when Kyrie Irving's Q score was like 1,000. It was like just peak Kyrie Irving. He was playing well for the Celtics. They were 12-2 without Gordon Hayward, and – everyone wanted to know how did Kyrie Irving turn into this player? He looks so thin and fit and in shape and lovable. And so I did the story about veganism and how he's like a vegan now. And I interviewed a couple players, and Garrett Temple is one of the other vegans in the NBA, or someone who has a plant-based diet. And he said, you know, when you think about it, isn't it kind of weird that we drink cow milk?
Yeah.
Like from the udder of a cow, like this is something that we grow up on. And I sat there and I was like, no, yeah, of course I drink cow's milk from their breast. Wait, what? That is disgusting.
Yeah. Yeah. We basically, I mean, the thing that's used to feed infants, that's what we eat from the cow. Like we're baby cows. We like being baby cows.
Like you would never be like, ooh, you know what? That cow looks delicious. I'm going to go suck on that teat. No. But that's what we do. That's what we like. They put a little like cartoon cow on the thing, and we're like, oh, this is great. I'm definitely going to drink this. It's going to be delicious.
Yeah, it's just whatever you're used to seems natural and seems normal, and that might be a good segue into talking about some of the reforms the leagues are doing. But I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. I think you know what I'm doing as 2020 approaches. I'm anti-segue. I think I'm just going to talk about what I want to talk about. I don't feel like I need to ease anybody into the bath of it. I think we're just going to do it. And I think we're just going to start. We're just going to start with you, Tom, as the king of superior wharfing things. I'm proclaiming you that to the public. I might have done it in private, but I think everybody needs to know. And for those who do not know, the superior wharf hypothesis is that giving a name to something helps people conceptualize it. We've discussed it on the podcast before, but it's why, for instance, load management has become a problem for the league. We gave a term to it. It was one thing when players were missing games before due to rest, but now we give a term to it and people can see it everywhere. Anybody listening to this can probably recall a time that they were introduced to a word and suddenly they saw that word everywhere and they started thinking about that word more. Now, Tom, I think most prominently did this with gravity. You are the creator of gravity, right? You're the Isaac Newton of the NBA.
I'm God.
Good job, by the way.
Yeah, thank you. Gravity was, I'm going to totally take credit for this. Kevin Pelton also did a lot of work with this at the same time while we were at ESPN. The idea of gravity, that Steph Curry is so good, not because just of his field goal percentage on long distance shots, but because he has this magnetic appeal where players gravitate towards him and then other players get open. And therefore, everyone who plays with Steph Curry suddenly gets better because of that gravity. And that was something that hadn't really been part of the NBA vernacular.
Yeah. And it's something that nobody would have denied if you described it as a phenomenon, right? Everybody would have said, yeah, that makes sense. The players stick to them. But giving it a term just allows us to discuss it in conversation and attach other concepts to it. And there's a value. There's a value in thinking deeply about things and giving a name to those things. And in some ways, I think it's an underrated value because it shapes how we think. Ever wonder how to get the hottest new sneakers? The ones that barely hit shelves? The answer is StockX, a revolutionary new marketplace for buying and selling 100% authentic sneakers, streetwear, watches, and handbags. Millions are already using StockX to find everything after it sells out, from the latest Yeezys to every retro Jordan to the hottest new streetwear from brands like Supreme, Bape, Palace, and Kith. StockX.
Yo, Ethan, remember when you bought those sky blue 11s?
Oh, the ones that were completely legitimate, but I was disbelieved by many of our friends.
Right? There was a controversy about whether they were real or not because of the price you got. But now with this, with StockX,
they would have to believe me. Guaranteed. They would have to believe me.
Exactly.
If I got a price that low on some Jordan 11s in StockX, you would be a fool to doubt me. So with that in mind, do you want in on all the hype? Check out StockX.com/bball for a surprise offer that won't be around long. That's StockX.com/bball. Check it out today.
You gave a little Sapir Whorf alarm for what you're coming out with. And okay, so there are a variety of things we want to talk about, but let's start here. You have written an article and it is on the Sapir Whorf alert, guardification of the NBA. Can you explain what you're talking about?
Yeah, that was a very like radio question segue into the question. Hi, I read this thing that you wrote.
Well, no, you got to make it clear that you didn't actually read it. Your producer mentioned it to you without saying that. But
do you get that when you go on a radio show and it's clear they just scrolled through your Twitter feed? You recently wrote a story about the top picks from the 2020 draft. What did you learn in that? Story.
Yes. You know, Levitard, I think, is the biggest sinner when it comes to this, where he will just say, what did you write in the article? And I think to myself, it was 5,000 words. I don't know how to just recapitulate. Look, writing the article is hard enough. I don't know how to give the summary of it on the fly. I'm not sure. But yes.
It's sad when he Stu Gotzes you, right? It's sad.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, I didn't read this. Just tell me. I'm not going to do any of my homework. Just tell me what I need to know.
Hey, I read this article and B,
I didn't ask you for the entire recapitulation, just the definition of guardification and the phenomenon of it.
All right, so you're seeing bigs particularly playing like smalls or playing like guards. Smallification of the NBA bigs doesn't really – I don't know if that really comes across. But guardification is something that I've noticed where Karl-Anthony Towns, as a headline stat, Karl-Anthony Towns is shooting more threes and shooting at a higher percentage than Stephen Curry did in his 2015 season, MVP season.
True.
You have LeBron James, who's the size of Karl Malone, leading the NBA in assists. You have Luka Doncic, who is by every like measurement possible, a power forward, 6'7", 230 pounds. He's heavier than Xavier McDaniel. He's about the size of Charles Oakley and Anthony Mason, and he's second in assists, and he's a point guard. Then you have Kristaps Porzingis taking logo threes. You have Joel Embiid taking threes. You have all these bigs, Nikola Jokic, who is basically a point guard for his team. They're all bigs who play really far away from the basket. And what that does is it makes an interesting, I don't know, juxtaposition of what we think a traditional big man should do, but it also creates injury risk that I wanted to investigate for this story. Is if we have bigs who are asked to guard on the perimeter, like if you're asking Rudy Gobert and Clint Capella and Dwight Howard to guard 30 feet in, what does that do for your joints? What does that do for your the health and the wear and tear? If you're no longer just banging around the rim, you're now asked to be a guard defensively. And that was something that I think in this load management conversation, Ethan, is totally lost, is how the game is more demanding on these players.
I think it's a great observation and it's a good way to put it. In a way, we've discussed how the game is different and switching. It's a little abstract. Just saying that some of these big guys whose bodies maybe were never meant for this are now exploring their talents and moving in ways that it's really unprecedented. I mean, the stat on Towns is incredible, but and you highlight the way he's playing, which is also good to highlight because you can see it. It's not just a matter of they flip the ball to him and it's going up from deep. A lot of the time, he is taking step backs and trying to get space. He's running around like Steph Curry off the ball and running a guy into a down screen and then popping out behind the arc. I think that we never had big guys do things like that. And it's just a big experiment. And like you know, how we are used to milk or used to cheese, for instance, I think we're just used to big guys doing certain things. And so that's why we haven't really explored these spaces. I say we like I'm a coach, but why coaches haven't. And now coaches are starting to finally break from that tradition. And we're seeing these bigs behave like guards. But here's the thing that's interesting to me.
Okay, Pablo.
Here's the thing.
Here's the thing.
I don't know if I'm imitating Pablo. Is that even an imitation? Is the other good question. If we want to get into some,
the transitive property would suggest that you or I am Pablo, right?
Yeah.
Because if I'm you, just East Coast Ethan, then I am also Pablo.
Oh my God, that is way too much to handle right now.
You were saying, here's the thing. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh yeah. Why isn't the guard? The actual guard, the guard size guard, why hasn't he been excised from the league? It seems as though I would have thought, look, everything's going bigger, faster, stronger, bigger, faster, stronger. And yet we have Trae Young really coming out and having a great second season. And somebody within the sport said to me that it's a 1-5-9 league. And that was an interesting way to put it, which is you get your one and you get your five and then everything in between, it's flex positions. It's guys you can play between those positions that you fill out the roster. And it seems like the one, the regular human sized one, has not lost their place in the NBA. And we're just seeing more and more of them. And if you look at the upcoming 2020 draft, that's where the talent appears to be. It's in guys of that size. So what's happening there?
Yeah, I mean, look at what's happening in Charlotte where Kemba leaves and everyone's like, oh, our season's doomed. And then this dude comes out of nowhere, the second round pick, Devontae Graham, suddenly is averaging about 20 points a game and 7 assists and looking like Kemba. And the other flip side to your argument, Ethan, is if we're operating with these quick guards in space that can blow by people and they have freedom of movement. Does that make everybody Kemba Walker?
Mm.
You know,
and
like
then,
if,
and then the quickest, smallest guard is the most Kemba-y. Is that the idea? And so there's always going to be a place for that. Possibly.
Like,
and
is it just easier to be good at point guard because of the fact that you're operating in space? And does that mean that everybody is just more efficient because they're operating in space?
Yeah, I think so. I just would have thought that people that size might have been pushed out because of the new trend was switching and guys who can guard any position. In theory, a 6 foot one guy, I mean, that's often what they are in socks, would be at a massive disadvantage or put your team at a massive disadvantage. But it appears that their capabilities offensively are just so crucial that there's still a place for them. And yeah, if you have a guy like Luka at 6'7", then that's a superstar. But there are just only so many guys of that size who can run an offense like a lead guard can.
Well, I think the way this conversation changes is, all right, now if we understand the physics of this, and I talked to Dr. Marcus Elliott of P3, who is just got like a Harvard Medical School Lifetime Achievement Award and presented data, a study from P3's sports science facility in Santa Barbara. They have 58% of NBA players on opening night rosters, data on how they move, their biomechanics. So they have tons of data on their biomechanics, how they move, the way their joints move when they jump, when they land, when they move laterally. And they analyzed the data and found that they could predict just purely on the way you move 70% of knee injuries in the NBA. Major knee injuries in the NBA. They could predict within the year that this player was going to have a major knee injury. And he presented this information to Harvard a couple weeks ago. And the idea is, hey, we need to focus more on Zion Williamson. We need to focus on Kristaps Porzingis. We need to focus on these bigs who are huge, but have been basically coasting their way through the lower levels because of their size. But at the NBA, they need to optimize the way they move or else they're going to have knee problems. And Kristaps Porzingis blew out his knee a couple years ago. Zion Williamson just had surgery on his meniscus. And you have Kawhi Leonard who has tendinopathy. You have all these big or like large dudes. DeMarcus Cousins just tore his ACL. These biomechanics are becoming super important. And they're not optimized because when you're 7 feet tall, Ethan, you can get by at, you know, fifth grade, eighth grade, if you're the tallest dude. But as soon as you get to the NBA and you're not moving right, man, that is going to be bad for you.
Well, does that segue us to what the NBA is doing as far as these reforms are concerned with the in-season tournament and maybe not cutting back on the amount of games, but instead trying to repackage it? I must say, I am confused. I'm confused by this. I'm very confused. I try not to react to things in the moment. I try to see the wisdom of whatever is being floated or implemented. I think there's too much of a tendency to go, oh, how stupid. But I looked at this and it just doesn't seem like the solution to me. I'm still a little bit confused on how the whole thing works. I'm a little insecure about my lack of understanding of it. What is your take on the floated in-season tournament?
So there's a few things here, right, Ethan? There's on one end of the spectrum, I can see why the NBA is doing this, right? They have, I think the ratings are down 18% year over year compared to last year. They have load management in the national headlines. Probably the number one story of the season so far is look at all these injuries and players sitting out games.
I want to do a negative victory dance, by the way, for being negative and having it validated that I've been banging this drum for a little while. And it feels like everybody has finally one day woken up and come to my Chicken Little, the sky is falling conclusion. So I just need just a little ding of validation, Jade, if you can add that. You were saying, Tom.
Yeah, and I do want to talk about that too, because I think what the timing of the story from ESPN, Adrian Wojnarowski and Zach Lowe reporting that there has been serious discussions by the league on like a four-pronged major overhaul of the season. And when I hear major overhaul, I'm like, oh, they're going to cut down to like 66 games. They're going to get rid of back-to-backs. No, that is not what this is. What this is reshuffling those 82 games or 80-ish games and trying to create these mini tournaments to draw interest at different parts of the season. So one of them is an in-season cup, in-season tournament that would require all 30 teams to participate. And I don't know what they get out of it, but they get a trophy. they get a trophy. And they're trying to wrestle with this. Well, what else is there? Because this is modeled after European soccer, right? But the issue with European soccer is that they have been doing this for a long time. And so it's ingrained in the culture of the sport, whereas in the NBA, you don't have that. And so you have to start from scratch. And the timing of it, Ethan, makes it seem like this is a response to load management. I don't know that it is. Tom, if it is a response to load, yeah.
I heard they – I'm not a big Premier guy, but Dufour was telling me they don't even play their starters for those games.
Which is the other thing here, Jade, is that if you are going to do an in-season tournament, will the stars even play? Like, what is the incentive if a star player is like, hey, this seems like a gimmick. Yeah. And why would I do that if my goal is to be healthy in the playoffs, right? And that's one of the problems. The other problem that I see is if you attach a reward – say a draft. I've saw this floated around somewhere that a draft pick, like you get the winner of that cup automatically gets a draft pick. I don't think you understand that NBA players don't want to hear about draft picks. You know why? Because that's their spot, right?
This
like
is amazing.
People don't understand that if you're going to play a tournament to get a lottery pick or a top five pick, the players aren't going to be happy about that. Why am I busting my ass to go lose my spot on the team?
You know, we call that up here in Connecticut, Tom.
What's that, Jade?
Lipstick on a pig.
I thought it was going to be a bear in the backyard. it is a crazy incentive. It is strange. It's like your wife wanting you to do something with her and then saying, and then if you do it, I will go on a date with another man. Like, wait a second, what?
and maybe the alternative is like, hey, you lock in a playoff spot in 4 months. But then like, what if that team that wins a tournament in November crumbles and then suddenly you have this bad team getting waxed in the playoffs because they won 6 months? What? All right, Ethan, what this is, the schedule is just too long. The season's too many games.
Yeah.
That's the problem. We're dancing around the issue. The problem is that there are too many games, and the load management problem is the turd in the punch bowl. And there's a lot more drinks to be had at the party. It's not just the turd in the punch bowl. It's the fact that there's Trulies at the party. There's old fashions at the party. There's big, bold reds that you can drink. And that when there's the turd in the punch bowl and you can't escape the load management conversation, if you turn on ESPN, if you turn on your favorite sports radio show, if you go to the cocktail party, everyone's talking about the headline issue of load management. And even though I think I've tracked this, Ethan, that there's only been like 18 games, even less than that, that have been affected by load management, quote unquote. However, it's magnified because it's such a delicious thing to talk about on national radio.
And now the fans are doing load management. They're not watching so many games. They're pacing themselves. They're skipping more games. And yeah, I think that's the issue, is it's the hard thing. I don't want to pretend like it's easy to just suddenly drastically alter the schedule. There are a lot of unintended consequences that come from that. I wouldn't say just do that, but it almost seems like they are unable to do the hard thing. So then they do the, as Jay would say, the lipstick on a pig thing, and it doesn't totally work. And the funny thing is you see them implement these aspects from football that I don't think have anything to do with why football is popular. I don't think America loves football because it has replay review and coaches' challenges. I don't. I don't think that's the secret to the success. I would venture to say secret to the success is scarcity. Not too many games. Once a week, everybody knows what day it's on. I think that's the thing, but that's not the thing that they're taking. Instead, they're now taking the coach's challenge, which, as you wrote about, it's just been a disaster. It doesn't work too well.
Coaches hate it. The people who are supposed to benefit hate it. you know, and it's maybe one of those be careful what you wish for is, but, you know, I look, the turd in the punch bowl is a real issue that the league has to fix. The PR problem that the NBA faces now, which is that the players are soft. They're, for lack of a better term, like when I tweet about load management, I just hear boomers in my mentions saying they're just a bunch of pussies, you know?
Yeah,
and that's and what that, yeah. that's the PR the image of the NBA athlete. It's hard to come back from that. And no matter how much you write or I write or the Kevin Arnovitzes of the world write, how these players are banged up, they're not pussies, they're not wimps, they're not pampered. They're injured. A lot of these guys are injured and they have long-term careers that they're caring about. And it's not a matter of them not fighting through it. You can't fight through a torn ACL. You can't fight through a torn meniscus. You can't.
Yeah.
And so no matter how much we get on that soapbox, Ethan, the average fan, the casual fan that the NBA cares about, the millions out there that they're trying to draw to the screen, all they hear about is the national pundits like Charles Barkley saying these stars are pathetic.
Yeah, that's a branding problem. And maybe it's not the signature reason that we've seen this dip in interest, but it's a culmination. And you have a little bit and then you have a lot of it and then it penetrates the national consciousness. And it's what everybody's talking about at the party. I think the main problem with this tournament, though, if you just do a 30,000 foot view of it, and you mentioned how Jade mentioned how there's a tradition and they're used to it in soccer, for instance. I think it's just too complicated. I think it's too complicated to break through the noise of everything else people are interested in. Sirit Sohi of Yahoo brought it up to me that the main problem with it, it's like in Mad Men when they were trying to market High Lie. For those who don't know, it's that was it a game where you throw a hard ball and a horn? Is that what High Lie is?
Yeah. Yeah, you sling it.
Super big in Connecticut.
And Miami.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We have a big highlight joke.
I actually, when I was a kid and my family took me down to Tijuana, we saw some highlight and it was confusing. It was pretty interesting, but it was confusing. But Don Draper says when they're having the marketing meeting of highlight that Americans are just going to be so confused by that J in highlight. They're never going to get over it. And I think there's some truth to that this is just – It sounds like some simple things that need to be absorbed, but at the large public level, when you are changing traditions, you're going to cause a tremendous amount of confusion. Hey, here's a theory. Would Luka be a bigger star by now if his name was just Luka Donk? I'm convinced that just that itch at the end and the struggle of American sportscasters of knowing how to pronounce it. Is it ick? Is it itch? I think that right there that just knocks 30% off his Q rating versus Luka Donk. Luka Donk is a way bigger star right now.
Wait, is this the Antetokounmpo corollary too?
Oh, I would think so. Now it was such great branding. I sound like Darren Ravel. Such great branding that they came up with the Greek Freak. I think that really helps him because
Luka does roll off the tongue though. Luka sounds fun, and you know, like branding 101 is replace C's with K's and people remember it more. So like Kleenex, Kmart.
Oh,
You replace C's with K's and suddenly everyone just for whatever reason X's and K's stick in your brain more than the alternative. So I think Luka is actually fine.
Yeah.
Doncic, forget about that. But Luka, I think, is good enough. And Giannis, but I still didn't you say Giannis a lot?
Yeah, I've been terrible. I've been terrible on the pronunciation. I mean, now I can say Giannis Antetokounmpo and hopefully it goes well. But I've never been good at pronouncing his name. I think the phonetics of it screwed me up. And, it screwed me up about as badly as when we had what was it? Was it E. Yonleon come into the league? Yeah. That was very difficult.
I think it was I'm not even going to go there.
Yeah, yeah. Whatever it was the opposite of what it looked like when you read it.
So I think the in-season tournament is a gateway drug, okay? I think the hope from Adam Silver is not that this is going to change everything. The hope is that owners will dip their toe in the water of reforming the schedule and say, you know what? That worked. Let's keep it going. And maybe the end goal for Adam Silver is to get to 58, to get to 66, to get to 70. And that these are just dip the toes in the water measures to whet the appetite, to torture that analogy. It's like, here's an amuse-bouche. Now here comes the appetizer and the entree.
Look at Top Chef Tom. Yeah, what if Adam Silver's playing the long game? What if this coaching challenge is that, where these coaches have been complaining about calls forever, and Silver goes, hey, you guys think you're so smart. You think you're so correct all the time. Well, I'm going to let you know. I'm going to let you know how often you're right about this. We're going to give you a challenge, and you're going to be right about it about 30% of the time. So just keep that one in mind when we take this away. He plays the long game, Adam Silver. He's Long John Silver out here. I like it.
Wow, Long John Silver.
Mm, there you go.
Well, so, all right, then let's – the things I do like, the play-in tournament. I like that. I like the play-in tournament. I like the idea of creating a race at the end of the season – for multiple spots, not just the eighth spot. I like the idea of games mattering. And this is, it comes back to the season is too many games. The games need to matter. The games need to matter. Right now, the regular season games do not matter to the point where Kawhi Leonard did something unthinkable. He rested all of the back-to-backs, took off all the back-to-backs and said, screw it. I'm not doing that. I am not playing in those back-to-backs. And he won a championship, which was a cool story for Toronto, but in many ways just lit this load management thing on fire. Because now, Ethan, Russell Westbrook, Blake Griffin, Kristaps Porzingis, Kevin Love, Kawhi Leonard, five all-stars have not played a single back-to-back this year.
Wow.
So where does this go? Like that's the thing that I like that the NBA is looking at schedule reform. I do not think that 78 games is the like when I read the report and it said a minimum of 78, I was like, ooh,
yeah,
this can't be the end goal.
The NBA is open to a lot of different ideas. In a way, they often come up with things to make me go, I appreciate the thought, but what were you thinking? You're trying to solve these problems. I just don't understand why this was the particular solution. And I don't know what's going on with that. I was on Danny LaRue's podcast. I was ranting and raving about the clear path foul. That's something where
LaRue.
Danny LaRue. Like True Detective season one, like Reggie LeDoux, Danny LaRue. I was ranting and raving about the clear path foul because I just don't understand that as a solution to anything, that they grind the game to a halt and try to figure. I think there's this issue with the NBA, and they probably have their reasons for it. It might be rooted in Donaghy, but I think a lot of this might go smoother if they just gave refs more power. Which I know how people react to that. They go, I don't want refs to have more power. I just think that
if you did your rant about clear path foul on Danny LaRue's pod, why are we doing it here again?
Well, this isn't the exact rant. I mean, the rant was a real rant. I was yelling. I was literally yelling. I was aggravated.
Radio Ethan came out a little bit?
Yeah. Radio Ethan in reality came out. So I'm not letting the tiger out of the cage in that way. But I think some of the issues might be in the way with lawmaking, how sometimes we don't give judges discretion. We say there are mandatory minimum sentences and we try to force a decision without knowing the exact context. I think it would be a better product if we just acknowledge that different refs have their different styles. You know, a lot of the time these stars are yelling at these refs, not just because they're frustrated at the call, but because there's a sense of there is a specific way this should be called by everybody. And it's not realistic. I think it worked better when there's a sense of, oh, that's how Dick Pivetta calls it. You know, like I'm pissed off at him, but I've just got to work my way around how this guy calls a game. And maybe you give the ref the discretion to go, I know what it looks like when somebody is breaking up a fast break. I know what that looks like. That's what that was. That's why that guy grabbed the offensive player. I don't need to go back and replay it like the Zapruder film, back into the left, back into the left, back into the left, and determine which guy's foot was ahead of the other guy's foot. I can just make that call and have my own discretion. I think in a way, if the referee was more respected, we would get a better product, even though that's a hard sell because people hate refs so much.
Well, to relate this to load management is that they came out in 2017, the NBA came out with an important document, a memo sent to all the owners and governors saying, here are the rules regarding rest. This was in response to Steve Kerr and LeBron James. The previous season, they were resting on back-to-backs that were on Saturday ABC games. And smartly, the league decided to do something about it and say, hey, we gotta nip this in the bud. We can't let this load management, DNP resting, players resting, get out of hand. So here are rules. And they listed out all these situations that teams were going to be subject to at least a $100,000 fine if you rested multiple players in the same game, if you rested them on the road because, hey, you only get one chance in many cases to see Kawhi Leonard. You can't do it on national TV games. And since 2017, I'd venture to guess there have been over 100 DNP rests, but I'm pretty sure, and I should follow up with this, apologies, that zero have been fined.
Mm.
So since 2017, they had these rules. They legislated the DNP rest violations. And I don't know of any that have been actually fined. However, we do know that there have been dozens and dozens of DNP rests, and yet that has been deemed okay by the league office. And in that report from Zach Lowe yesterday, Brian Spruill said that the NBA has not found that any player has rested against their policy in national TV games yet this season.
Hmm.
And I'm sitting here, I'm like, come on, why are we doing this? Why can't we just call a spade, right? Why can't we just say they are resting? And when Kawhi Leonard is out for two national TV games due to what was officially listed as load management knee on October 30th and November 6th for national TV games, now we're going back and saying those are okay, right? I just think the answer here is cut back-to-backs away out of the schedule. Start there. That would nip this conversation in the bud. You wouldn't hear the words back-to-back anymore. You wouldn't hear load management nearly as much.
He's just missing the game. Like George Kittle's missing a Niners game. It wouldn't be thought of as strategic.
Right. And you know, like the Major League Baseball has this. They have DNP rests all the time. It's called a five-man rotation. Starters, it's too risky for a starting pitcher to pitch in back-to-back days. It's too risky. So they figured out that 5 days or 4 days is the right amount of rest. Right? There's no legislating that out. There's no rule in Major League Baseball that, like, hey, you have to pitch in 4 days rest. It can't be five. So that's been normalized in baseball. Also, star players take Sundays off a lot. Like, they just take Sunday off. So it's been normalized there. In the NFL, they get a week off, and we have this understanding that Thursday games are going to be worse because of the lack of rest and recovery. So they've normalized it in those sports. But the NBA, the medical information is saying, hey, this is bad. This is bad for your body. It's raising risk. This knee is going to blow up if we play in this back-to-back. Let's sit you. And I don't know how you legislate that without just saying, let's just get rid of back-to-backs.
I think they have to get rid of back-to-backs as well. And how to do that again, I keep saying this on the podcast. We're not approaching these issues as though they are just easy to solve. I don't think Adam Silver has an easy job. Far from it. Because not only do you have to come up with the right ideas, you need to get a majority of the owners to implement them. And then on certain ideas, this tournament, for instance, you need the consent of the players' union as well. And there are so many different incentives that are colliding into one another. So I think it's difficult. I do.
What about the reseeding of the top four?
I like that. I think I like that overall.
I don't really think it changes the game.
I enjoy the idea of you choosing the team you play. Is something that intrigues me as well. Yeah.
I love that idea. Tell me more about what you think it should go down. I love this idea.
well, this was something that Danny LaRue might have introduced first. But it's, hey, if you've got the top seed, you choose your opponent. It gives a little bit of extra spice, maybe. You've already disrespected your opponent by choosing them. Plus, I think gives you more incentive to win games in the regular season and have that top seed because, hey, it would be nice to be able to choose your opponent. Obvious downside, perhaps we get fewer upside. Perhaps we get fewer upsets.
It might be mitigated by the chip on the shoulder Clippers thing last year. It's like, hey, like, you don't think we can win because we don't have a star player? Well, screw you. We got Pat Bev and we're going to, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. We've taken this personally, and maybe you could even have some big presentation of the selection when the selection is made.
Yes.
I don't know how you would do that. Yeah.
Why not? It's great. It's great. And it plays into the whole soap opera of the NBA, which is that it feeds on itself. And this talking point doesn't get point talked enough. Okay. The idea that, Zach, all right. So I was out with some friends here in Charlotte last night, and I said to them, did you know that the best game of the season happened down the street on over the weekend? The craziest finish in the NBA happened. Zach LaVine had 27 points or whatever in the fourth quarter and led like an all-time comeback and had 49 points. It was insane. It was an insane finish against the Charlotte Hornets. And they were like, no, I didn't know about it. And I was like, did you watch SportsCenter today? And they're like, yeah, and it wasn't on. That's because there's too many games. The storyline of Zach LaVine having an amazing 49-point game was already out of the news cycle because they played like two games since then. Whereas in the NFL, the games are spaced out and you can talk about the upcoming games and talk about Lamar Jackson and how amazing he was for 4 days straight. Whereas there's just so much churn in the NBA, there's not enough time for fans to understand what's going on because they got to play the next night and the storylines just flush down the system.
That's a great point. There's way too much information out there and there is this advantage and we are seeing it. Yeah. Jackson has been running through the news cycle for the last few days. That's something that just doesn't generally happen with the NBA. It was happening with Luka, but then suddenly Luka played another game and looked terrible. So, you know, it's like, okay, now we need to recalibrate and maybe he has another good game and the MVP conversation gets started up yet again. So
there's so much whiplash.
Yeah.
Hey, what's up, listeners? Jimmy and Vallejo here. Crushing it at work like I am? Laser focused on beating that boss level? Doesn't mean you shouldn't eat. DoorDash can help you get your next meal from your favorite restaurants in minutes. Not only is your favorite pizza joint already on DoorDash, there are over 340,000 restaurants in 3,300 cities. So you might find a new favorite too. I like to experiment around, kind of check out the different spots, try to find that new favorite. Right now, our listeners can get $5 off their first order of $15 or more when you download the DoorDash app and enter promo code Strauss. That's $5 off your first order when you download the DoorDash app from the App Store and enter promo code Strauss. Don't forget, that's promo code Strauss, S-T-R-A-U-S-S, for $5 off your first order from DoorDash. Nosh on that grub, folks. Jimmy out.
Something else, the whole thing that precipitated us doing this podcast, you texted me and said that NBA Twitter is becoming an island economy. Now, maybe that is a term of art in some economics class. I don't know. I might not be smart enough to know what you're talking about, but I would like to know. I'm intrigued.
Remember when you called the Warriors winning the title in the preseason?
Vaguely. I vaguely remember
that. Yeah, remember that? And how cool it was and how it felt like so much like validation when you called ahead of time what was going to happen. You were a fortune teller. You were Nostradamus.
I think
the public calls me Straustradamus.
I think that is the name. I didn't choose it. The people who love me so much chose it for me. So
exactly. There you go. I think that has permeated throughout. It's all your fault. You are patient zero. It has permeated through our conversation and the way we talk about the NBA now, where it's not enough to point out that Luka is amazing. You have to point out that you were first to that party, that you were on Luka Island before everyone else was. And we
so you're saying everybody wants to be me, Tom. They want to be in this car freezing and doing a podcast inside their Prius. They see how I'm living. They want this life. It makes sense. I get it.
Who put this thing together? Me. That's who. Who do I trust? Me.
The island economy is such that everyone has to colonize NBA takes, NBA players, NBA trends as their own. And so what ends up happening is we start acting like our dogs and start peeing on all these trees. And that way, when things happen, you can say, hey, I was first to that story. I was on Wiggins Island. See all you people who did not believe in Andrew Wiggins. 5 years later, suddenly he is coming to fruition, and I was on that. And I do this so much. Is this not
I mean, I was just doing it on Bad TV Ratings Island, which seems like a very unappealing island to live on. But that is the island. That is my island, if anybody wants to join me on it.
Feel when someone has that take, you have this little itch inside you that says, wait a minute, I was saying that before you.
Yeah. Oh, it happens, and it must be hard to resist from – especially some people who have superior wharf some things as you have, as Kevin Arnovitz has, where I've talked with Kevin about these things, that certain phrases are used all over the place and without any kind of attribution.
Used one of an Arnovitz word in my story today that you can find on NBCSports.com, the My Teams app. Download it now to get all the latest.
Jade, edit that out. Instead, I will dub over like, at The Athletic. Subscribe today. I'm Tom Haberstroh.
Logan Murdoch. You can find Logan Murdoch on the Habershow podcast. Yes. So the I use the word shuffle. Like Jeff Teague shuffles over to set a screen. And that's definitely an Arnovitz word. Right. Like, I think I first read that 10 years ago from Kevin Arnovitz.
Arnovitz came up with the acronym PUJIT for pull up jumper in transition and probably some other things.
The PUJIT sound.
I feel badly because I didn't come up with the death lineup for the Warriors. Vinny Goodwill at Yahoo did. But people keep trying to give me credit for it, even though I didn't come up with it. That's something that happens repeatedly. There is this desperate fight to have been first retroactively. I think we're sensitive to our reputations and having some value, and there is no real scoreboard of this. And so it's tempting. I try to resist the urge more than the urge comes up. But yeah, we are trying to get ahead. We are trying to be early adopters. And I don't know what we're doing because the early adoption is so rarely remembered.
I think it's just stroking our egos.
Yeah,
I think it's just insecurity that, hey, I wrote about DNP rest before everybody else. You know, I was the smart one. I was beating that drum before anyone really cared.
But you know what it is as well is that when you're out on a limb, you really feel it, even if it's on the most ridiculous issue. And you'll sound completely absurd describing it to your wife that this was a big risk career wise in your life. It feels as though you don't have a lot of validation, and it's a little scary. You don't want to be the goofball. And so when everybody starts to come to your side, there is this tremendous urge now with the security.
Floating to your island.
Yeah, you are floating to the island.
Wait, I own this island. This is not your island. And you're get away. Bearded, building a wall.
You're all bearded and emaciated, wild-eyed, crazy. You all mocked me. You mocked me, and now you want to be on my island?
So I think about this a lot.
Right at them.
Yeah. Wilson. So I think one of the things that we have to talk more about is, why do we do this? Is it just ego stroking? Is this just the receipt nature of Twitter? Is that there's always receipts to your takes? And so you can say, hey, I wrote about this, you know, 2 months before you did. Or I talked about Zion Williamson as a number one pick before you did. I talked about LaMelo Ball and said, while everyone was hating on the Ball family, I was saying LaMelo Ball should be the number one pick. All these things, I think it's just the natural instinct of that we all feel insecure about our place in the world.
I think that's what it is. It's why I like Colin Cowherd's Colin was right and Colin was wrong, that he does the both things, because a lot of people don't do both. They only do the I was right. But I'm
Keith
also
Law
just
does that too. Yeah,
I like that. I like that. I also just enjoy Colin Cowherd in general. I think he's a true maestro of the radio arts.
Yes. Yeah. He is.
God, I love it. I just the way he phrases things. I mean, he is a superior warfer of analogies. I just stay for the analogies. A lot of the takes I don't even agree with, but I just remember in the finals where he was talking about Kevin Durant. Last finals, and he was, Austin, Texas. It's in Texas. It's not of Texas. Okay, it's not of Texas.
That's very good.
Kevin Durant, he's on the Warriors. He's on the team, but he's not of the Warriors, and he never will be.
I know, right?
How does Colin Cowherd ever close his mouth? I just feel like he talks just lips open the entire time.
I think he does, but so good.
I have high appreciation for guys that could just do it on their own and do it well on their own.
Yeah.
Dan Lebatard once told me that there's only two people who can talk about any topic in sports and sound educated and sound like they just well-versed and articulate on it. It was Colin Cowherd and Bomani Jones.
Yeah.
They are so good.
Talents.
Crazy talented at being a talking head, you know, having a take on everything that seems thoughtful. Not that it's not thoughtful, but like that they've thought about this. But Bomani's a master at this, and same with Colin Cowherd. And that is something I think we should do more of, which is admitting that we were probably overzealous in X, Y, and Z, or we missed on this. And you said it in your column. I think we need to – what was the word you used with Pascal?
Oh, don't underreact.
Yeah.
That's the other thing that happens, is that there's caution. There's a lot of caution about sample size and don't overreact. And that's this other insecurity of we want to present ourselves as the sane, level-headed, sports-wise people, and all these knuckle-dragging – fans or prisoners of the moment. But no, we understand sample size. We get it. And I was just saying that might be true, but a lot of the time we're actually underreacting to these significant events. I like what you do in your columns, where you're talking about buy or sell, and you're coming up with the justification of why a new trend will continue versus why it is short-lived. I think that's another good way of thinking about it. But the blanket, oh, these fans. I first noticed it when that terrible this is going to be fun Lakers season came about with Steve Nash and Dwight Howard and Kobe, where the Lakers obviously were not up to the hype. And there was a lot of poo-pooing at the beginning, instead of maybe just reacting to what the public was reacting to. That sometimes we can tell. Sometimes we can see it. Now, there are other times, the Miami Heat Big Three season, that first season, where a lot of people probably overreacted to how they began that. But I just don't think it should be reflexive. I think it's worth the conversation. When we see something unusual, it's worth discussing whether or not it will persist versus whether it won't.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be, hey, I had this before you.
Let's just, you know what? I think let's not learn any lesson. Let's not learn any lesson, Tom. That's what I'm down. That's what I'm going to end the podcast on. I think that we have absolved ourselves like a confessional. We have absolved ourselves merely by admitting that we do this. I don't want to give it up. I'm too addicted, Tom. I want to claim retroactive credit for everything. I don't want to change my behavior. Not at all. I'm going to continue to keep peeing on trees. That's where I'm at.
Yeah, you can. You can. And I think one of the things that I struggle with is when I feel like the way Twitter has evolved is that we have to check in and say, I'm part of this conversation.
Oh, that's the thing to resist. That's the thing that's so tough, because I often will see something happening and think to myself, I have thoughts on that. I've had thoughts on that for a while. What do I just let this happen without letting people know that I have those novel thoughts on it? What? It's hard to fight. I will say though, when I joined The Athletic, and I was a little bit nervous because I hadn't written about basketball for a while. And I just, hey, how is this going to go? Will I still do this decently? And I was dropped into the middle of the playoff run of the Warriors. I think it might have been, man, was it in May that I was dropped in there? Yeah. So in the middle of, I think it was the Western Conference Finals. And what I tried was I didn't tweet about any of my in-game observations. And I was tempted to, but I just didn't do it. And I found that my articles were better despite being rusty. And I was more present when I watched the in-game action. And I immediately hated myself like Paul Rudd because I just thought, what have I been doing all these years? I should have been taking in the game and just filing things away. There's this other thing too where people, I don't want to call it stealing from you because we're all just sharing ideas, but you float an observation you have out there, then there are going to be a bunch of people who start pulling on that particular thread. It was just much better not to do it. Now, if you're somebody like Nate Duncan who can make a granular observation every 2 seconds, then that's all fine and well. And I think it's part of how he sells his podcast. So it's probably a good idea for him. But we're not all Nate Duncan, and we have different kinds of responsibilities. And at least for the two of us, the main products that we have are what we write and what we say on a podcast. So I don't think that it's a good idea to just throw it into that particular void.
And I think I get that insecurity too.
Oh, yeah.
When I came back from my paternity leave, it was the beginning of the season and I felt like I was out of the loop. Like I hadn't tweeted about the NBA in like a month. And I was like, man, the whole world forgot about me. And then there's the whole like leaving ESPN aspect of it. And like when you leave ESPN, you suddenly don't get that blowtorch or the megaphone of all your colleagues being like retweeting your stuff. And you have Brian Windhorst and Ramona Shelburne and just your work is just blown all over the internet. And then you like feel, oh man, maybe I don't have it anymore. And you get insecure about, hey.
I like that double entendre, by the way, that you just completely just pushed right on through. You were saying the blow it all over the internet. But anyway.
I just feel like – this is – I feel – I felt coming – I felt coming back to the NBA space. I felt like I was not no longer producing good work, and that I had to tweet about games to feel like I mattered, and that I had to. When Zion did something amazing, I felt like I had to tweet about it. Or when Luka did pulled up from 40 feet, I had to scream, "Hey, he just did a Luka logo three!" Remember when I had the term "loco"? Logo threes, logo Lillard. Remember, I came up with that idea. Hey, everyone, why aren't you paying attention to me? I still exist. Oh, why didn't I get enough retweets? Ah!
I like too how we all become cheesy action stars, or when a player does something, and you see this from the accounts from Bleacher Report and these other accounts where Luca said, ba 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 ba. It's what the action figures say when they are about to kill somebody. You got to say some sort of pithy line. That's part of it.
Yeah.
Well, let's be like the NBA, never really change your behavior on the core issues. I think that's what we need to do. I could talk forever, but I'm getting text messages. There is no daycare, Tom, no daycare on the day before Thanksgiving. So I do have to wrap things up. Is there anything else? Anything we should check out? Anything we should see of yours? Give your plugs.
Yeah, Haber Show podcast. Go binge on that. It's lots of people like Gerson Rosas, who's the Minnesota Timberwolves, kind of pulls back the curtain on the Timberwolves' hot start. And my columns at NBCSports.com and the Dad Pod at Count the Dings should be coming out soon. And I talk about being a hopeless dad in this space. Yeah. So go do that stuff.
His name is Tom Haberstroh, folks. I know it well because I stole his identity in an elaborate fraud. And thanks so much for listening. Everybody have a happy holidays, and we will be back trying to save the NBA because we're just such great people. That's what we do here. Thanks to the listeners. Thanks to Jade. Thanks to all.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. I do have one more for you, for a lovely audience that you've been here at the House of Strauss. This song is called "He's Writing a Book About KD." He's writing a book about KD, Kevin Durant. He's writing a book about the dynasty. It's called The Victory Machine. He might regress to the mean. He's writing a book about KD.
Name is Ethan Strauss.
He's the host of the House of Strauss.
He's walking around here. Don't talk to nobody.
Comes all the way from California. Now he lives in the Bay.
He's walking here.
He's been covering the Warriors for a couple of years now.
It's gonna take you to
and he's
the
talking to all those players, looking around.
Survey, then write something like that.
Got a notebook, talking to people in the corner. Who knows about what?
Grow up.
But you know what? He's writing that book. And it's about KD. It's about KD, Steph Curry, and the dynasty. I don't think KD's gonna like it very much, but
yeah,
he's just gonna have to deal with it. That's it. But he's gonna have to read a book about KD. One more time. He's writing a book about KD, Kevin Durant. He's writing a book about the dynasty. It's called The Victory Machine. He won't be too mean. He's right in.